Okay, so good evening, good afternoon. Welcome to this inaugural lecture of the Hatton Chair on Climate Law. My name is Jorge Viñuales. I'm a professor of law and environmental policy, and I will be moderating the event. First, the lecture by Professor Van Asselt, and later on the panel that will provide some reactions and some initial thoughts to the ideas that Professor Van Asselt is going to share with us tonight. I would like to briefly introduce some aspects of this very cherished tradition in Cambridge of conducting an inaugural lecture. It is not done that regularly, and that's unfortunate, because it is a very important moment, not only for Cambridge, for the institution as such. And I should mention something which is important for us, is that the Hatton Chair is the first endowed professorship in climate law in the United Kingdom. And that the aim of the chair is to advance research and teaching with a view to strengthening legal responses to the ongoing climate crisis. So it's not just about theory, it's about practice. And Cambridge is very proud of that interlinkage. I will briefly introduce a very long biography of my friend and colleague, Harold Van Asselt. I have selected some aspects of that biography just as an impressionistic view of his many accomplishments, and then I will give the floor for the main aspect of tonight's event, which is really the lecture that is co-organized by Cambridge University and also LUIS as part of a partnership signed a few years ago. Professor Van Asselt joined Cambridge in September 2023 as a Hatton Professor in Climate Law, as well as a Law Fellow at Hughes Hall. He is also a professor of climate law and policy at the University of Eastern Finland and an affiliated researcher with the Stockholm Environment Institute. He is a former editor-in-chief of the Review of European Comparative and International Environmental Law, RECIEL, which is one of the top peer-reviewed environmental law journals. And he has held several visiting research and teaching positions in a number of leading international institutions, including Utrecht University, the University of Georgia, the University of Strathclyde, Bar-Ilan University, the Tokyo Institute of Technology, and the Finnish Institute for International Affairs. Professor Van Asselt has published extensively in the field of climate law and policy, covering developments in international, European, and national climate law and governance. His books include The Fragmentation of Global Climate Governance, The Art and Craft of International Environmental Law, second edition with Dan Bodansky, Governing Climate Change, Cambridge University Press, 2018, co-edited with Andrew Jordan and others, The Politics of Fossil Fuel Subsidies and the Reform, CUP 2018, co-edited with Jakob Skovgaard, and The Research Handbook of Climate Finance and Investment Law with Michael Melling. His work has appeared in the leading international law journals, including the American Journal of International Law, the Journal of Environmental Law, Transnational Environmental Law, and others, and importantly, particularly for this field, in leading interdisciplinary and high-impact journals such as Nature, Science, Nature, Climate Change, and others. That is no small feat for a lawyer, particularly these days. Professor Van Asselt has contributed to high-level reports informing policymakers, such as the IPCC's sixth assessment report, working group number 3 on mitigation, specifically on chapter 14. And also very importantly, the emissions gap and production gap reports that have been very carefully considered by the International Court of Justice recently in a landmark advisory opinion. In addition to that, Professor Van Asselt is very often cited in international media, including the New York Times, Reuters, The Independent, Al Jazeera, and Politico, as well as in more climate-specific media, such as Climate Home, Nature News, Climate Wire, and Carbon Pulse. Professor Van Asselt holds a PhD with distinction and a Master's of Law from the Vrije University Amsterdam, and his lecture tonight will be on the globalization of climate law. Haro, you have the floor.
Thanks. Thank you, Jorge, for this very kind and very generous introduction. And good afternoon, friends and colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. In July this year, the path-breaking advisory opinion by the International Court of Justice found, among other things, that the goal of global warming, to keep global warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius, is the parties' agreed primary temperature goal under the Paris Agreement. 10 years ago, the District Court of The Hague in my home country of the Netherlands issued a similarly groundbreaking ruling in the Urgenda case, with the court imposing an emission reduction target on the Dutch government. This ruling led to various similar court cases in other countries, including Belgium, Ireland and New Zealand. Over the past 5 years, the London-based Chancery Lane project has compiled almost 200 draft clauses that any company can use to strengthen the climate alignment of their private contracts. Earlier this year, a group of African experts published a model climate change law framework for Africa to support African parliamentarians in the development of climate laws on the continent. And then 2 weeks ago, the US State Department railed against what they called the European-led neocolonial export of global climate regulations when challenging the net zero framework, which is a global mechanism that puts a price on shipping emission that was due to be adopted last week by the members of the International Maritime Organization. Last Friday, the adoption of this framework was postponed by a year after the Trump administration had threatened to retaliate against the government's voting for it. Now, these somewhat disparate snapshots of developments in climate change law have something in common. They all concern, in one way or the other, the spread of climate law across the globe. In other words, they illustrate that climate change law is on the move. Now, the spreads can be seen as a sign of the pervasive nature of climate change and the growing recognition of the important role of law and legal responses in addressing this challenge. However, as I will argue during this lecture, it is vital to carefully examine why, how, and with what effects climate law is traveling. Such an analysis, as I would argue, can help to generate insights into the actors, the processes, the potential and the limitations of the diffusion of climate law. It can also help to inform more effective legal interventions in pursuit of global climate goals. But conversely, not paying attention to the ways in which climate law travels can lead to ill-advised legal mismatches. Now, the lecture will be structured in 4 parts. I will begin with explaining how I understand the concept used in the title of my talk. I will then briefly discuss the extent to which climate law is spreading. Then the next and the main part of my lecture will explore why and how climate law is spreading through 4 different but complementary lenses. And in the final part, I will set out my agenda for future research. Right. So the title of my lecture may raise some questions, maybe even some eyebrows. What do I mean with globalization? And what actually is climate law? Let me unpack both concepts. Globalization, of course, is a contested term. And for many people, it has negative ideological connotations associated with economic globalization driven by capitalism and free markets. A broader way of thinking about globalization was suggested by the legal scholar William Twining, who sadly passed away 2 weeks ago. Twining's broad definition is of a large fragmented horde of processes that tend to make human beings increasingly interdependent. And this definition stresses the growing political, economic, and cultural interconnectedness in contemporary global affairs. This interconnectedness is driven, for example, by global trade and markets, by global communications, global travel, global networks, and to stay on topics today, global environmental problems such as climate change. This globalization, I would argue, is very closely intertwined with the law. Globalization is shaped by the law. For instance, global business transactions very much depend on local laws, such as Delaware's corporate law, which governs the transaction of many Fortune 500 companies. In turn, globalization also shapes the law. The growing interdependence between actors across the globe affects the development of the law, allowing for legal ideas to travel more easily across borders. It is this process of globalization of law that I'm particularly interested in. Now, to be clear, especially here since we're here in the Lauterbach, the globalization of law that I'm talking about goes beyond the development of public international law. Indeed, if anything, legal globalization challenges traditional Westphalian thinking by questioning the boundaries between national and international law, and even the boundaries between law and non-law. The globalization of law in principle also goes beyond the transnationalization of law. However, a valid question can be asked here. How global is the very concept of globalization, as well as related concepts that have been put forward, such as global law and legal globalization, or the globalization of law? Do these concepts truly have worldwide application, and who actually resides in the global village? Another key question related to the concept of globalization is whether it should be considered inevitable, unidirectional process. And recent development actually suggests that it shouldn't. The World Economic Forum is already talking about globalization. And we might even be moving towards deglobalization, as indicated by the onshoring of production processes, trade protectionism, and also increasingly stringent immigration policies that we see across the world. Now, I'll return to these points of the definition of globalization in the final part of my talk. Now, let me now turn to the second concept, the second key concept, that of climate law. And indeed, the question of what is climate law becomes rather existential for the Hatton professor of climate law. Now, while some scholars have suggested that a new legal discipline of climate law has emerged, others see climate law simply as the application of various areas of national and international law to climate problems. In their view, climate law is like what the American Judge Easterbrook called the law of the horse, a disconnected set of rules applied to a single subject. And indeed, if we look at climate law, it indeed involves various bodies of law, including private law, right, like with subjects such as the law of torts, company law, consumer law, contract law, as well as public law fields such as constitutional law, human rights law, and planning law. So is there then such a thing as climate law? Well, can one identify climate law as a body of norms that has a degree of substantive coherence that sets it apart from an area such as environmental law? Or if we lower the benchmark just a little bit, do the different areas of law that apply to climate change have something in common? When answering the same question for the field of environmental law, the American lawyer Todd Agard suggested that an area of law is a legal field if it exhibits patterns associated with common and distinctive features that predominate within the area to an extent that justifies studying the area as a distinct category of legal situations. And arguably, or at least I would argue, that climate law exhibits some of these patterns. First, it is able and it's possible to observe an emerging community of self-identified climate lawyers. I'm one of them, who have their own journals, their own organizations, their own conferences, their own courses, and indeed their own professorships. Second, climate law is deeply tied to a body of climate science that demonstrate with a growing degree of precision the impacts of climate change on the different scenarios, the vulnerability of communities and ecosystems to those impacts, and the required mitigation and action needed to avert those impacts. Third, the climate problem has certain temporal and geographical dimensions that affect its regulation. As a so-called super wicked problem, climate change and therefore also climate law require a sense of urgency. At the same time, climate change is also what the political scientist Tom Hale calls a long problem, meaning that climate law must overcome a temporal disconnect between the problem's causes and its ultimate effects. This is shown, for example, in the challenges that lawmakers as well as courts face when calculating a carbon budget that balances responsibilities between present and future generations. And in terms of its geography, the global commons nature of the problem means that the actions of many actors across the globe are all interdependent. This has important implications for law. It suggests that cooperation between actors is required, among others. It also means that legal responses in any given jurisdiction need to consider spillover effects, such as carbon leakage or the impacts of technological innovation. And it raises key and difficult questions for legal doctrines, such as causation. And then lastly, climate law has an identifiable normative core, which is informed by the objectives and the principles emerging from the international level. So climate law, therefore, in my view, has certain distinctive features that suggest that it may be maturing into its own field of law. But then the question is, where can we find this law? This brings me to the next part of my talk. So at first glance, there are clear signs that that the spread of climate law is, or climate law is spreading across the world. This is also what you show, see shown here in on the slide. Now, the Climate Change Laws of the World database, hosted by the London School of Economics' Grantham Research Institute, which is represented here by Joanna Zetzer, keeps track of the number of laws directly relevant to climate change. And using these data, researchers have suggested that the number of climate laws increased tenfold in the 2010s as compared to the 1990s. But perhaps more importantly, the number of countries adopting these laws has also grown, with virtually all countries in the world now having some climate laws in place. And that the adoption of these laws is not happening in isolation is suggested by an econometric study from a few years ago, which found that the propensity to legislate on climate change is heavily influenced by the passage of similar laws elsewhere. The use of one type of climate law in particular, which is dedicated framework climate change laws, has become increasingly prevalent. Such laws usually set a long-term mitigation target and then put in place the necessary procedures to achieve that target, including interim targets, monitoring, reporting, planning, the establishment of scientific advisory bodies, and with some laws also including specific provisions on climate change adaptation. By now, as you can see here on the slide as well, nearly 70 countries have adopted some form of framework climate law, which in several cases has been modeled after the 2008 UK Climate Change Act. Now, another indication of the globalization of climate law is the number of countries adopting certain climate policy instruments, with carbon pricing in general and emissions trading in particular playing a major role. According to the International Carbon Action Partnership, emissions trading systems are now in force in at least 38 jurisdictions across the globe. This includes not only the well-known EU ETS, the EU emissions trading system, but also trading systems in countries such as China, Kazakhstan, Korea, and Mexico. And further systems are underway in countries such as Brazil, India, and Turkey. Another example of the spread of climate law is that countries have increasingly extended environmental impact assessments to also account for climate change impact, as Benoît Meyer, who is also here with us in the room, has shown in his latest monograph. And then last but not least, the global expansion of climate law can be illustrated by the clear upward curve of climate-related court cases. Again, the LSE's Grantham Research Institute publishes, many of you will notice, an annual global trends report in which it takes stock of the climate change litigation landscape. And in its latest iteration from July this year, the report found that there are by now nearly 3,000 cases. Although the number of these cases is heavily concentrated in jurisdictions such as the United States and Australia, the cases span nearly 60 countries, including increasingly countries also in the Global South. Now, while these various examples offer some basic insights into the spread of climate law, several caveats should be made at this point. First, much depends on how one defines terms such as climate change legislation or climate change litigation. It may be relatively straightforward to capture legislation or cases that are clearly relevant to climate change, for example, because climate change is mentioned as such. But it's much more difficult to understand trends in laws and in cases that are only indirectly relevant to climate change. And narrow definitions of climate law ultimately tell us very little about the way in which other areas of law, such as tort law, consumer law, or tax law, are adapting to climate change across the world. The second caveat, the number of climate laws or court cases does not necessarily correlate to climate action. The quantity of climate laws ultimately says very little about their quality, including their ambition, their sectoral scope, their fairness, their implementation, and their enforcement. As such, this discussion offers only a partial picture of the spread of climate law, and a systematic assessment of the extent to which different norms and legal interventions across different areas of law are diffusing across the globe is still missing at this point. However, even this partial discussion already shows that it's probably premature to speak of a true global spread of climate law. Now, let me now turn to the drivers and mechanisms, legal or otherwise, underpinning the globalization of climate law. Of course, the globalization of climate law is closely related to the very nature of the problem, with the causes and impacts of climate change implicating all parts of the world. Moreover, as I mentioned earlier, the globalization of climate law is also intrinsically related to the broader processes of globalization, with global supply chains, cross-border information flows, and the global nature of financial flows both enabling and necessitating the movement of climate law. Now, to be very clear, my ambition is not here to provide a unified theory of the drivers of the spread of climate law, but it's rather to demonstrate the potential value of considering the globalization of climate law through different lenses. And the lenses that I'll adopt are those of public international law, comparative law, policy diffusion, and transnational law. And since we're here at the Lauterpacht, let us start with public international law. Now, this is also coincidentally the field where my own journey into climate law started, focusing particularly on trying to understand how different international legal regimes all related to climate change interact with each other. And these regime interactions are closely related to a broader phenomenon, which is the growth of international environmental law. And Simon Young and Bob Percival point to this growth of international environmental law as one of the drivers of what they call global environmental law. And similarly, one could also argue and say that international law and public international law can help to spur the travels of climate law. Now, studying the development and implementation of public international law, particularly where it has universal or near universal reach, can help shed light on the dissemination of climate law across a broad set of jurisdictions. International law can help to spread legal ideas, such as environmental impact assessments or emissions trading. And in addition, international treaties can compel states to develop homogeneous rules that subsequently require implementation by a broad group of states. One very clear example, in my view, of this is the diffusion of international norms that can be traced back to the climate change treaties, so the Framework Convention on Climate Change and particularly the Paris Agreement. And one of those ideas is that of net zero. The Paris Agreement's aim of achieving a balance between anthropogenic emissions by sources and the removal by sinks of greenhouse gas emissions of greenhouse gases in the second half of the century has influenced the adoption of net zero targets by a variety of governmental and non-state actors. By now, we have 137 national governments that have adopted net zero targets, and also companies covering nearly $37 trillion of annual revenue have likewise set such targets on a voluntary basis. One could also say that the 1.5 degrees goal, which was referred to by the International Court of Justice, can help drive the spread of climate law by not only providing a benchmark for national governments, but also by providing a goal that private actors should strive for. For example, by signing up to voluntary standards, such as the Science-Based Target Initiative or the Climate Bond Standard. International court decisions can also facilitate the spread of climate law by providing clarity on states' obligations under international law. And here we can refer to the European Court of Human Rights decision in the Klimaseniorinen case, which suggested that states ought to adopt measures with a timeline for achieving carbon neutrality, to set intermediate targets and pathways, and also make sure that those targets are updated based on the best available science. These are steps that arguably can be and could be fulfilled through the diffusion of framework climate change laws. Although a public international law lens can therefore help to provide a basic answer of why and how certain legal norms spread, it only offers a partial view. The study of international legal norms as well as their implementation in different jurisdictions can easily miss out on the origins of concepts, norms, arguments, and other legal ideas. More importantly, a study of international legal norms does not necessarily reveal how legal ideas get translated in different contexts, and why some jurisdictions may be more or less receptive to such legal ideas. And this is where comparative law comes in. Comparative law, at its core, is about understanding similarities and differences between legal systems, as well as the causes of those similarities and differences. Whereas public international law may put an emphasis on norms applicable to all states, comparative law resists uniformity and foregrounds diversity, highlighting that different geographies come to the climate problem from multiple angles, with different histories, different cultures, responsibilities, vulnerabilities, priorities, and capacities. Comparative law also holds the promise of learning lessons across jurisdictions, in some cases inspiring legal reform, and in other cases helping to understand what is likely not to work in another jurisdiction. And indeed, it is in the comparative law literature where we can find a veritable wealth of concepts trying to capture the travels of law. transplants, transfers, export and imports, borrowing, circulation, migration, contagion, transposition, legal mobility, diffusion. You can find them all. These concepts can all be used to understand the globalization of climate law. And to give you some examples, one example is that the EU put millions of euros into the promotion of its flagship instrument, the EU ETS, in the hope that it would serve as a global mold that could be transplanted and it could be exported to other jurisdictions, such as EU accession countries and even developing countries. And indeed, countries like Kazakhstan have used the EU ETS as a model for their domestic system. And similarly, as I already mentioned, the UK Climate Change Act served as a model for framework climate change legislation that could be diffused also to other countries. And maybe to give an example at the subnational level, there's a recent initiative which is called the Model Climate Laws Initiative of the Sabin Center at Columbia University, which has involved the drafting of various sectoral model climate laws that could be circulated at the state level in the United States. And these are all climate laws, but we can also say something similar about climate change litigation. Climate litigation also involves efforts to develop legal strategies, to develop legal arguments that can be replicated elsewhere. Going back to the Urgenda case, Roger Cox, who was the lead lawyer behind that case, was explicit about this goal when he wrote after the district court ruling that, I'll quote, "It is hoped that legal scholars from around the world and in various fields will further explore the potential of these developments for their jurisdictions and for bringing new national and international climate cases to court." Indeed, Cox himself and the Urgenda Foundation he has worked with have been involved in efforts to transfer some of Urgenda's legal strategies and arguments to other jurisdictions with varying degrees of success. But decades of comparative law scholarship have warned us against a very simplistic conception of transplants and point to the necessity of considering the existing regulatory framework as well as the existing legal culture. And indeed, if we continue with the EU ETS, Anatole Boot warns that the EU ETS should be considered an impossible transplant unless major modifications are made that would adapt it to a local context, particularly taking into account the prevailing energy market regulation. His analysis and other analysis as well help explain why, even though there may be some basic similarities between the EU ETS and other emissions trading systems, the outcomes are often very different. Now, although comparative law scholars try to be mindful of the local context in which legal interventions and ideas need to be implemented, William Twining, same person I referred to earlier, points out that comparative lawyers still tend to approach diffusion as a rather simplistic process. They largely assume that there's only one source country and one destination country, that diffusion is unidirectional, that the main exporters are countries in the global north and the main importers would be countries in the global south and economies in transition, that the transferred laws arrives in a legal vacuum, that there is a discrete moment in time in which the diffusion takes place, and that there's little change in the legal object that is transferred. Each of these assumptions can be and should be questioned empirically to allow for a richer account of how climate law travels. And in doing so, lawyers can draw on scholarship in the social sciences, on policy diffusion, which brings us to the third lens. Now, although not necessarily focusing on legal rules and institutions, political scientists, sociologists, and other social scientists have had a very long-standing interest in the mechanisms through which ideas and innovations, including policies and norms, diffuse. And the work in these disciplines is characterized by theory and concept building, as well as empirical studies, both of which can be used and can benefit the study of the diffusion of climate law as well. But perhaps most helpfully and most importantly, the work has introduced a basic typology of diffusion mechanisms. And I'll discuss these mechanisms briefly. The first mechanism, that of coercion, involves powerful actors forcing certain legal ideas upon other jurisdictions. And one could argue that that some of the legal instruments that have been adopted by the European Union, including the carbon border adjustment mechanisms, including deforestation regulation, are forms of soft coercion. And through these instruments, the EU uses its market power, as one example of what Anu Bradford calls the Brussels effect, to compel third countries to either adopt a carbon price or to adopt due diligence measures to prevent deforestation. Coercion may also involve international financial institutions, such as the World Bank or the IMF, making funding dependent on certain types of climate reform. And second, the second mechanism, which is that of competition. And this mechanism involves the diffusion of laws and policies through which different jurisdictions compete with each other for resources, including capital and market share. An example in the climate context is probably by now well-known green tech race, with several major powers competing to attract clean energy industries through trade policy and through subsidies. Green industrial policies, such as the United States Inflation Reduction Act from 2022 by the Biden administration, which in itself was a reaction to Chinese support for its domestic clean energy industry, were quickly followed by similar policies in other jurisdictions, including in the EU with the Net Zero Industry Act. Now, third, through the mechanism of learning, policymakers and other stakeholders use the experience of other countries to estimate the likely consequence of policy change. Learning across different sides is indeed very essential for the policy-centric climate governance world that we're faced with. And learning can be a simple process, but oftentimes it's complex and it's actually quite difficult to demonstrate. Still, some studies suggest that learning has played a role in the diffusion of carbon and energy taxes in Northern Europe in the early 1990s, as well as in the EU ETS, who learned lessons from the acid rain training program in the United States, also in the early 1990s. And then the last diffusion mechanism is that of emulation, which involves countries adopting laws and policies because they view them as appropriate. And this mechanism is closely related to what constructivists call norm diffusion. And arguably, this is what we're seeing with a number of countries deciding on their own to restrict fossil fuel production through moratoria, as well as through the removal of fossil fuel subsidies. Now, these mechanisms help to draw attention to the processes through which climate law diffuses. However, with the exception of emulation, much of the literature suggests a seemingly rational process of diffusion, thereby largely bracketing the political dimensions of policy diffusion, including the roles of different actors and their interests in the diffusion process. Which brings us now to the final lens, that of transnational law. So transnational law was famously defined by Philip Jessop in 1956 as all law which regulates actions or events that transcend national frontiers. Basic but important definition. Now, over the years, transnational law scholars have paid close attention to the role of transnational private lawmakers, to the role of transnational legal mobilization, as well as the role of various actors other than states in the making and implementation of public international law. And in particular, I would say that transnational law and transnational law angle can help to shed light on two aspects that are less well covered by the other lenses that I discussed. First, transnational law underscores the role of transnational private lawmakers in climate lawmaking. For example, in the same way that public international law can set standards that are subsequently spread to different parts of the world, some influential private standards can also influence and indeed have influenced the development of climate law. One well-known example is the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, whose recommendations for company reporting of climate risk have been built upon in mandatory reporting standards across the world in countries such as Brazil, Hong Kong, New Zealand, Singapore, as well as the EU. And also in the area of emissions monitoring and reporting, many governmental standards these days have drawn on what originally were private standards, including those developed by the ISO. Another form of transnational private lawmaking is the use of contracts. Here, a transnational law lens draws attention to the practices and the procedures underpinning these climate-related contracts. For example, many carbon contracts, such as emission reduction purchase agreements that are used for carbon credit transactions throughout the world, have their roots in the common law. This means that the increased use of these contracts is accompanied by common law legal practices, favoring courts, law firms, and other organizations familiar with this legal system. Private standards, by virtue of their incorporation into legislation or their enforcement through public bodies, thus help to globalize climate law. Now, the second value of transnational law is that it also reveals the role of so-called transnational networks. Let me focus on a few actors in particular. One of them is judges. And judges engage both formally and informally in what Anne-Marie Slaughter calls transnational judicial communication. This happens through initiatives such as the Global Judicial Institute on the Environment and the Asian Judges Network on the Environment, which offer judges from different countries an opportunity to learn from their respective approaches to climate-related cases. It also happens through citation practices, with some courts referring to climate cases outside of their own jurisdiction as legal authority. And similarly, litigators, NGOs, and philanthropists as another set of actors have also created their own transnational networks. Several organizations, such as the Climate Litigation Network, as well as Our Children's Trust, seek to diffuse legal strategies by sharing scientific, legal, and communications-related expertise with others. And similarly, NGOs, transnational NGOs, such as Greenpeace and Client Earth, are active in multiple jurisdictions and seek to connect their activities across borders. And all of this is facilitated by the growing availability of information on climate cases. Open access databases such as the Sabin Center's Climate Litigation Database make pleadings and rulings available for thousands of cases. Moreover, what we're seeing now is that courts are anticipating their use in other jurisdictions and therefore already translating the rulings themselves. And we saw this, for example, in my home country, in the Milieu Defensie versus Shell case a few years ago, where on the same day that the appeal came out, the court were already issued a formal translation as well. Again, all of this is demonstrating how courts and other transnational actors can play a role in the globalization of climate law. Now, this kaleidoscopic and multidisciplinary discussion shows that there's value in a multi-layered approach to studying the globalization of climate law. Building on the insight from these different lenses, what should come next? Let me offer my main takeaways for a future research agenda on the globalization of climate law. First, as Natasha Affolder has very forcefully argued in her work on contagious environmental lawmaking, the globalization of climate law necessarily involves some form of agency. Whether it's a judge deciding to use a case from another jurisdiction as legal authority, a government official reading about experiences with an existing emissions trading system, or a company council deciding to adapt a model contract clause from the Chancery Lane project, different actors facilitate the travel of legal ideas. Studies on the mobility of climate law therefore need to map and study these actors, their interests, their interactions, and ultimately their role in the circulation of concrete legal interventions, including successes and failures. Second, comparative lawyers have already warned against the risks of exporter and language bias, which has led to an excessive focus on the diffusion of Western models, like the EU ETS, like the UK Climate Change Act, and like Urgenda. And clearly, legal ideas and innovations originate from different geographies, as illustrated, for example, by the pioneering decisions and rulings by the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, or more generally by the work by Jolene Lynn, Jackie Peel, and others on climate litigation in the Global South. But what we do not yet know is the extent to which such ideas and such innovations are being diffused. And this brings us back ultimately to the question of whether the globalization of climate law can be deemed truly global, or whether it's rather a process of transnationalization of climate law that mainly involves a limited set of jurisdictions. Third, the globalization of climate law is being and will continue to be resisted. Model laws will be rejected or adapted beyond recognition, and judges will reject foreign rulings as well. Indeed, if we look at some of the citations of Urgenda in other jurisdictions, we see that they were simply followed by a dismissal, suggesting that the findings of the case did not apply in a different context. And such resistance or rejection is not necessarily a flaw or an implementation failure. Instead, it reiterates the importance of tailoring legal ideas to specific legal cultures. And it should remind us that some legal ideas cannot and even should not be diffused without appropriate consideration of the domestic environment in which they are to be embedded. Now, seeking to understand the elements of a legal culture that may either facilitate the adoption of foreign ideas or engender resistance should therefore, in my view, be part and parcel of any future research agenda that seeks to inform legal reform. Fourth, further inquiry should also look into the types of legal ideas that are being disseminated and the types that remain confined to a limited set of jurisdictions. For instance, whereas carbon pricing systems are being adopted in a growing number of jurisdictions, as I already mentioned, the laws and policies banning fossil fuel production are still limited to a handful of countries. And this suggests that the type of climate law that is diffused is one that corresponds largely to what Jorge Vinuales has called the law of negative externalities, rather than the law that addresses the core production and consumption processes that lead to these externalities. Moreover, we should not just look at the diffusion of mitigation-related ideas, even though I talked a lot about them, but we should also try and understand to what extent, how, why, and with what outcomes climate change adaptation law diffuses. This is, of course, of particular importance and relevance for countries in the Global South, where coping with the climate change impacts is much more of a priority than reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And fifth, we should be careful not to assume that it is only legal ideas that promote climate action that can spread. Indeed, we may be at the cusp of a deglobalization of climate law, or maybe more accurately, the globalization of climate deregulation. And some have already started to refer to this as the Washington effect. Just think of the Trump administration calling on the EU to exempt American companies from the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism or the Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive's requirements to adopt a climate transition plan. And this is just the EU. With weaker trade partners, it may well be possible that the US government or other governments will demand climate deregulation in return for trade concessions, security assistance, or investment. Another example of how the diffusion of legal ideas may also undermine climate action is governments or companies drawing on arguments that pose barriers to climate litigation from other jurisdictions. So in my view, further studies, therefore, should also consider how legal ideas that can hinder climate action may be spread. And then finally, there is a need for further reflection on the meaning, the potential, as well as the limitations of the very concept of global climate law as a possible destination for the globalization of climate law. And such a reflection should go beyond merely descriptively asking if there is such a thing as global climate law, if it might be emerging, and what the common substantive principles or procedural rules would be. We need to also ask whether global climate law is desirable, how it could add value by including new actors and new sources of law, whose voices, whose norms would be included in global climate law, and how it ultimately can build on and potentially also affect existing domestic and international climate law. My hope is that, ultimately, through my work as the Hatton Chair here, I can help to kickstart these discussions. Now, while that brings us to the end of the substantive part of my lecture, I do want to end with a few brief personal reflections as well as expressions of gratitude. And just a warning, this will not be an Oscar speech, but still. So it should go without saying that taking up this position of the first endowed chair in climate law in the UK is a profound honor. But it also, in my view, presents an enormous challenge, and I've expressed this to a number of you already. And this is not just the general challenge that any new chair is faced with, right? Like producing excellent scholarship, doing great teaching. No, the challenges of this chair, in my view, are tied to the very reason why it exists, which Jorge already explained, which is the study of the role of law in addressing one of the defining and most pressing problems of our time. And just like climate law generally, the work of this chair requires a sense of urgency. It requires reaching out to other disciplines to better understand the problem as well as the possible solutions. It requires engaging with a variety of societal stakeholders to inform and inspire change. And it requires, perhaps most difficultly, a deep commitment to bringing about change at a time when it's all too easy to give in to doom and gloom. Now, I'm quite confident that I can take on these challenges because of the people that have been here and are there still to support me. As I said, I'm not going to name everyone, but I'm going to single out at least a few people. First, I owe a major intellectual debt to my two PhD supervisors, Professors Juita Gupta and Professor Frank Biermann. They have taught me how to bridge different disciplines, showed me the importance of supporting early career researchers, and have instilled in me the crucial importance of a fair and equitable response to climate change. Now, throughout the years, I've also been blessed with opportunities to work with many great scholars from different parts of the world, several of whom have become close friends and are indeed here in the room with us. You know who you are. These collaborations have shown me how much more can be achieved through working with others. They've also sharpened my critical thinking skills and taught me how research can ultimately make an impact on real-world decision-making. And then 2 years ago, as Warwick mentioned, I started, and it was a major change to my personal life, to my academic life. But I do think that my colleagues here at the Department of Land Economy, as well as my colleagues at my college, Hughes Hall, have, as well as the brilliant students, of course, I think, and there's quite a few of you here as well, have made it all very much worthwhile. And I think it's a true privilege that I could become part of this vibrant, multidisciplinary community of excellent scholars and students. And last but certainly not least, I want to thank my family, some of whom are here. You may have seen them. Some of whom are not here, they're online. And others who are sadly no longer with us. This all would not be possible, would not have been possible without your continuing support, belief, and patience. Thank you.